Good evening, everyone. The people will come in. They'll say we'll start. So, good evening, everyone. First of all, wonderful to see you all in person again after last week's break on Zoom. I figured out we'll be good to last week to have it on Zoom. Tonight, it's only cold, but we don't fear the cold. We're Canadians. Hey, that's what I was told. So, cold is fine. At least it's not snowing. All right, so we are talking tonight about chapter 6 and chapter 7 in the Megillah. So, we passed the middle of the Megillah. Last week, we learned chapter 4 and chapter 5. We said, if you remember, the Megillah is assembled out of 10 chapters. All right, so we did. We passed the half. So, Yisher Koach for all of us for doing so. As a quick summary of what we did last week, we spoke about what I call the turnover of Esther and Mordechai. If what we see that Esther in chapter 4, Mordechai is telling her that maybe this is the time for you now to reveal your Jewish identity. Who told you, who said maybe that's the time, only for this moment you became royalty and so on. We said that we'll see that from now on Esther becomes the main character, while Mordechai is actually only, I would say, supporting actor, or whatever you want to call it, if there was be a word for that. Michael, good evening. There's sources in the back. So tonight, it's going to be the climax of the story, I'll tell you, that we're one class before the end, all right? One class before the end. We'll do chapter 6 and 7. Next week, we'll do 8, 9, and 10. Don't worry, don't panic. The 10th chapter is really, really, really short, all right? And actually, I'll be honest, like, this is the climax of the story, all right? Like, again, try to imagine it being adopted to become a movie. So those chapters would be really the last scenes of the movie. Next week will be the epilogue, all right? That will be what happens after credits, all right? Those scenes afterwards. So really, this is now the climax. So I think we should start. We'll dive in. We'll see what exactly is going to happen here in the story. All right, so we'll read chapter 6 and chapter 7. What happened to my pages? Okay, here we go. So we'll read in English, and you can follow with the Hebrew, as I recommend a lot. That night, the king's sleep was restless. Maybe I should read it, right? Right, usually we read it in a special tune of Yamim Noraim for Shoshana. See, the minsters are here, so good evening. The resources in the back. Thank you for coming. So we read it in a special tune of Hamelech, of the Yamim Noraim for Shoshana and so on. We'll talk in a moment why we do it. All right, so that night the king's sleep was restless, and he said to bring the book of records, the chronicles, that they be read before the king. So a couple of things that I want to talk about. First and foremost, why do we read it on Purim with this kind of special tone, this kind of special melody? So that's based on a Midrash, like almost everything else. And I brought it, it's brought in the Gemara in Megillah in source number 1. The Gemara tells us, Rabbi Tanchum said, where we are, sorry. On that night, the sleep of the king was disturbed. Rabbi Tanchum said, the verse alludes to another king who could not sleep. Who couldn't sleep that night? Right. The king, Para, right? The sleep of the king of the universe, the Holy One, blessed be He, was disturbed. So whenever we read it in the Megillah, listen this year, if you haven't paid attention to it, we'll read it in a special tune, like we do when the Shliach Tzibur is starting, HaMelech. In Rosh Hashanah, same thing we do, at least in the Ashkenazi shuls, that the Baal Koreh, that also lends the Megillah, changes the tune and reads it like this, because it alludes to this Kadosh Baruch Hu. Alright, that also Kadosh Baruch Hu's sleep, so-called, was disturbed. Now, I'll be honest, I'll tell you, throughout history, there are a lot of sages, and the halakhic authorities, I should say, that don't really like this interpretation. Most of them would be the more rationalist and saying, like, really, how can you even talk about a Kadosh Baruch Hu in terms of sleeping and so on, and this and that and this and that. Some said also, don't read the Megillah in this special tune and so on. However, it's been in most Am Yisrael to read it, yes, after all, with this kind of tune. So that's why we do this in that sense. But you can see there's also other opinions, right? Like the sages say, the sleep of the higher ones, the angels, was disturbed. Not HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but the angels, their sleep was disturbed. And the sleep of the lower ones, the Jewish people, was disturbed. Rava said, this should be understood literally. The sleep of King Ahasuerus was disturbed. There's a lot to be said only on this piece of the Gemara. Like, what exactly are the difference in the opinions here? Kadosh Baruch Hu, angels, the Jewish people themselves, a lot of ideology behind every and each opinion, but not for now. All right? So just for us to know that when we're going to listen to the Megillah this year, try to pay attention for this if you haven't paid attention so far. So he wants this book. Like, I would tell you again, it seems like the characters of Achashverosh and the character of Haman are like, I would say, colored a little bit in the sense of not so serious color. Like, the king can't sleep, so what does he do? He reads a book. Or he wants other people to read him a bedtime story. Like, that's how it looks like, right? Like, think about it for a moment. He's a king. He says, I want someone to read me a book so I can fall asleep again. So let's continue. Verse 2. He was found written that Mordechai had told of Biktana and Teresh, two eunuchs of the king, from those who guarded the door, that they sought to send forth their hand against King Ahasuerus. You see, the rifle that appeared in the first scene shoots in the third one, and just like Shakespeare told us, we can see where he took his, his inspiration from. If you remember, we spoke about it, about Biktan Vateres, the end of chapter 2. We spoke about those two eunuchs of the king that wanted to assassin King Ahasuerus. They wanted to take over. We said that the popularity of King Ahasuerus was very low because of the entire empire went bankrupt after the war that he did with the Greeks. And now he remembers, he said, let's open the book. And with the Kadosh Baruch Hu behind, with this miracle, he opens this story and he's told about what happened back then. The king said, verse 3, what honor was bestowed on Mordechai for this, and was he raised? The king's attendants, those who served him, said, nothing was done with him. Nothing was done with him. What about this Mordechai? Did we do anything with him? Like, he really saved my life. Like, what about him? He said, no, nothing. He's still there. Again, you should remember, Achashverosh knows who Mordechai is. He's not anonymous. Achashverosh knows who Mordechai is. He's a minister in the palace. All right, so he knows him. He said, no, you haven't promoted him. And then, look what happened, what's going on. Verse 4. The king said, who's in the courtyard? Now Haman had come to the outer courtyard of the king's house to speak to the king about hanging Mordechai on the post that he had prepared for him. It looks like when we read it verse by verse, it looks like he just came at the middle of the night, right? But again, that's all the wisdom of the author of the Megillah. It's not exactly the thing. The point here, if you remember from last week, we said, and that's also a summary, at the end of the fifth chapter, Zeresh, his wife, told them you should build up this post, right? 37 meters high. 37 meters high. Try to think about how high that is. That we said, I suggested we should read it in Guzma, right? It's exaggerated. Like, there's no reason to build such a high post. But because Haman, at the end of last chapter, said, oh, I have so many boys, and I'm so rich, and I'm so strong, and I'm so this and that and this and that, then his wife, who's not part of his, I would say, supporters, right? As the Pasuk says, the supporters and his wife. His wife said, oh, you're so big, you're so good, you're so successful, so build a 37 meters post, and we'll see how that goes through. So we know that she told him, go in the morning and tell Achashverosh to hang Mordechai on it. So we should assume it happened in the morning. We shouldn't assume he just came at night to Achashverosh and just spoke with him, like, at night. Like, there's no reason for us to understand it. I would just say that's the way that, again, the authors of the Megillah decided to tell the story, to feel like one thing is chasing the other. All right? So Haman came, verse 5, the king's attendants said to him, behold, Haman is standing in the courtyard. The king said, have him come. Now, I want to pause for a moment and I want to say, there are some commentaries, modern, specifically more than modern commentaries, even though it is echoed in the Parshanim, that believe that behind the story here of Achashverosh and Haman, Achashverosh thinks that Haman wants to kill him. That's what they say, that Haman wants to kill him, and he thinks, he really believes that Achashverosh believes that Haman is coming over to assassin him. Why is that? First and foremost, it's based on a midrash. And take a look in source number 2. The midrash in source number 2 tells us this, as follows. King Ahasuerus' sleep was disturbed as he saw in his dream that Haman took his sword to kill him. He was frightened and awoke from his sleep. He said to his scribes, bring the book of records to read and to see what had happened to him. They opened the scrolls and found the matter that Mordechai reported about Bigtana and Teresh. When they said to the king, here is Haman standing in the courtyard, the king said, the thing I saw in my dream is true. This one would not come at this hour except to kill me. First and foremost, it's a wonderful midrash. It's trying to really fill the gaps in what we don't have here. And I'll tell you that not only in this midrash, but there are some modern commentators, and maybe I'll say it outside, they really read those verses as this kind of, I would say, almost a war or a small battle between Haman and Ahasuerus. And really, Haman came in order to kill Ahasuerus, or that's at least what Ahasuerus thought. Now, why is that? Why is that? For different reasons. First of all, we should say that when Haman built his 37 meters high post, all right, he built it that night. And we shouldn't assume, according to most of the modern commentators, we shouldn't assume that when someone builds a 37 meters post at the middle of the night, that no one knows about it. Probably, and of course, in what they needed to do back then, it was a huge constructing area, like there's construction all around. It couldn't just hide it from everyone else. More than that, based on Persian records, we know that the ministers lived close to the palace. They didn't live outside in the city. They lived close to the palace, close to where they worked. We shouldn't assume that no one heard about this post that Haman is doing because his wife told him. According to some commentators, what they say is that when Ahasuerus saw this post in the backyard of Haman, 37 meters high, he thought, wait a minute, that's probably for me. And then he wakes up at night, he reads in the book, and he reads something about that, again, someone tried to assassinate him. And then Haman comes in the middle of the night, according to this understanding. And he comes to him and he was sure who is in, when he asks who's in the courtyard, they read it as he's afraid. Like, who's here? That's night. Usually we know when the scene appears at night, it's because he's less confident, he has less guards maybe, he's able, he has this access to come to the king. If you remember, Haman already took the king's ring. If you remember, when he told him the decree, he gave him the ring. Like, Haman slowly takes more and more portion, more and more responsibilities from the king. Another thing that they say, those modern commentators, Grossman and others, they say, why would Ahasuerus understand, why would Esther invite him and Haman to the feast that we saw last week? Like, he says, like, something's going on. Haman is getting more credit than really he deserves. Maybe he's planning something against me. And that's how they read it. I think it's a fascinating reading. Put that in the back of your mind. We'll continue with that very, very soon. All right? You'll see that I think there is more and more and more to be said about this one. Let's continue reading. So take a look what happened. Haman came in verse 6. Haman came, and the king said to him, what shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor? Haman said to himself, whom would the king desire to honor more than me? Obviously. Now, it's a couple of things we have to say about it. A couple of things we really have to say about this. First and foremost, when the king asks this question, and I'll ask you before I say what I think, do you think that he really wants Haman's opinion? Like, he really wants Haman's advice? Or maybe not, and just asking for a different reason? And if that's not, you don't think that it's an honest question, then why is he asking it? What do you think? Let's hear you a little bit. I'll try to wake you up, guys. I feel like we're sleeping. Yeah. Yeah, Terry. This on the back. Sorry, yeah, Terry. That it went behind him.
Yeah. So this way, he's involving him right away from the beginning and saying.
Oh wow, that's a very sophisticated reading. No, really, it's a very sophisticated. It might be this. It might be this. I don't know. It might be this in that sense. I personally have a total different approach, but it's very interesting, Terry. Very interesting. I see it. I want to claim, and it's brought in, and again, also in Grossman, he says as follows. Look in verse 6. He said the question that he asked is, what shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor? Right? Honor. However, take a look in verse 3. Go 3 verses before. When the king is asking about Mordechai, he says, what honor was bestowed on Mordechai for this, and what and was he raised? In Hebrew we say, Yekar u'gdula. And here it's only Yekar. In other words, when Ahasuerus is asking his eunuchs, he says, raised, well, was he honored, and was he raised? And when we talk about, when he speaks to Haman, he says only, was he honored? What do you think to do a person to honor him, not to raise him? According to Grossman, I think it's a very creative reading. The reason that Ahasuerus is not mentioning the raising part of it, only the honoring part of it, is because Haman was already raised. If you remember, we go back to the second chapter. We talked about that Ahasuerus, the third chapter. We talk about that Ahasuerus raised Haman. Ahasuerus bayamim ahem gidal hamelech et Haman. Ahasuerus already raised Haman. He promoted him. Ahasuerus, according to Grossman, I think it's a very creative reading. He wanted to check here to see if Haman really thinks to speak about himself. He wanted to check if Haman really comes because he wants to have this honor. So he said, look, I'm not going to talk about raising. Why not? Because if I would say also, what should I do if I want to raise someone, Haman would say, obviously it's not me. He's not talking about me. Why not? Because I'm already raised. I'm already promoted. It's not about this. So Ahasuerus spoke only about honor. Honor. And that opened the window and the opportunity for Haman to really think and consider, maybe Ahasuerus is talking about me. Because if he would talk about raising someone, he would say, it's not me, I'm already raised. Like, what can really happen with me? Probably someone else. So Grossman said, I think it's wonderful. He says that even in the question, it's not that Ahasuerus really wants Haman's opinion. But what Ahasuerus is asking here is to check and to see whether it is true that Haman is planning anything on his behalf. Also from this question, right? So maybe we should see, it echoes the Midrash that said that Ahasuerus was threatened and was afraid that maybe he will be killed by Haman. All right, I think it's a wonderful, wonderful reading in that sense. Another thing that I want to focus on is Haman said to himself. How do we know that?
Can I ask one question?
Yeah, please.
How would the people of Anshe Knesset Gedola know what Haman was thinking to himself?
That's exactly the question. How did they know what Haman was thinking to himself? Do you have any answers? How do they know?
I think maybe it's based on the answer that Haman eventually gave.
Exactly. Because these are the things that he would have valued. Therefore, he must be thinking, this is what I would want.
So it's a beautiful, beautiful answer. Beautiful answer. And I personally agree with this reading. I mean, I have to agree with the reading. Unless we say, and we'll see in a moment, that some would say that the book was written in prophecy. All right, but if we don't say that, and we do say that it's based on them, then obviously, because Anshe Knesset HaGdola knows what is the end of the story, and they know the character of Haman, and they're trying to describe and to write him and try to design and shape him in a certain way, it makes sense for the plot to tell us that we know exactly what Haman had thought within himself. But again, that's a literal understanding of the story. It's not the only understanding. Because take a look. I brought in source number 3. Ibn Ezra, for example, who is very well known to be rationalist and Pashtan, he doesn't agree with us. Ibn Ezra in source number 3 says as follows. Now Haman said in his heart, there is an individual who says that we can learn from this verse that the scroll of Esther was written prophetically. For who, aside from God, who reveals his secret to the prophets, knows what is hidden in the heart. Only HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows what is written in the heart. Right? Others say that the author of the Megillah came to this conclusion by the use of his reason, which is what we said. Right? It is also possible, he gives another answer, that Haman later revealed his secret. He possibly revealed it to on his very day. Similarly, and Esav said in his heart, we have another place in the Torah where someone speaks to his heart. It's about Esav. We can talk about the comparison, not now. And the truth is, says Ibn Ezra, what I really, really think, the scroll was written under the influence of the Holy Spirit. That's how they knew. Now, I'll tell you, I'll be honest. It's not typical for the Ibn Ezra. If you learn a little bit of the Ibn Ezra on the Torah, Ibn Ezra is not the type of a parshan, of a commentator, that will easily say something like that. How do I know that it's not easy for him to say that? Because he gave 4 different answers. And that's something to know throughout commentary in general, not only on the Megillah. When we learn Rashi, and Rashi gives 2 or 3 answers, it means that none of the answers is perfect. None of the answers is perfect. Every time. If he gives more than one answer, he thinks there is a problem with each and every answer. The more answers you're given, the less, I would say, that the more flaws you can find in the answers. So the same thing is true also for the Ibn Ezra. That's why he doesn't think. But I do, again, want to follow your steps, Steve and Terry, and say, yeah, I think it's reasonable to say. They shaped the character of Haman in that sense. So there's no reason for us to think, why would they know? They didn't know. But it's part of the plot, right? It's part of the literature. Like, there's no reason to say something else in that sense. Let's continue. Verse 7. Haman said, the man whom the king desires to honor, let him bring royal clothing that the king has worn, and the horse upon which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown was placed, and let the clothing and the horse... Just a moment, let's pause. Think about the face of Achashverosh. According to the reading of Grossman, in that very moment, think about the face of Achashverosh when he's testing Haman to see maybe Haman wants to take over and wants to revenge and wants to assassinate him. When he listens to Haman and Haman says, bring a royal clothing, the king has worn those clothing, the king himself has worn those clothing, put him on a horse that the king himself has ridden, and put a royal crown on it. What do you think the face of Achashverosh in that moment was?
He wants to be the king.
Exactly! That's a wonderful reading that he really tests here, Haman. And when we read the Megillah, or we listen, someone that's reading the Megillah, we don't pay attention to all these details. But this dialogue here, I think it's a wonderful reading, is actually a dialogue between Achashverosh and Haman. King Xerxes the First, we know, which is Achashverosh, he wasn't dumb. He wasn't stupid. He was a very smart king. Very wise king. He lost the battles that he lost in the Greek Ocean and so on. He lost it. But he was a smart and a wise king. Even if the Megillah will try to color him not as smart, then still we know historically he was smart. That's why I still say, even when we read about Achashverosh, we should not read it in a sense that we only, you know, underestimate his intelligence and so on. He is a smart king. He's a successful king. And also we should read, maybe he is testing Haman to see that. So think about it, right? Royal, the royal clothing, the king, and so on. Royal crown, continue in verse 9. And let the clothing and the horse be given into the hand of one of the king's noble officers. What happened to the crown? Where's the crown? Right? What happened to the crown?
In the safe.
Still on the head.
In the safe. Okay, it's in the safe. I remember I went to London once, and in London, if you visited in the London fortress and so on, you can go and see the crown of all the different queens and so on, right? And all the royals. So I remember that everyone said, you have to see the crown. I said, okay, we'll go to see the crown. I went with my grandmother. We went there. You go into this place, if you visited, and if you haven't been there, you don't have to be there. It's really not that special, but I'll be honest. But you walk into this room, and you have this kind of electric kind of like you have an airport. How do you call it in English? Like you can stand in that, the sidewalk just walks by itself. Like a rail, like how do you call it? Like a moving sidewalk, whatever you want to call it. You stand there, they don't want people to stop and take pictures, so it moves you, and you see this crown, and this crown, and this crown, and this crown. Then the crown of Queen Elizabeth when she was inaugurated. You see it for really 15 seconds, and you continue on to your life. So, I agree, it might be in a safe. It wasn't the best moment of my life, all right? It's not something that I have to see the crown. It's a crown. All right, it's a crown. It was in those boxes, and everyone looked at you. You're not going to touch anything, and so on. But what happened to the crown here? What happened to the crown? Where is the crown? Let the clothing and the horse be given in the crown. All right, wait a moment. Was the answer? Sorry, Avram. What?
Maybe the king is
wearing it. Maybe he's wearing it, but he asked. I want the crown, and now he's not mentioning the crown anymore. So one second, Terry. One second. Let's finish the verse. So, and let the clothing and the horse be given into the hand of one of the king's noble officers, and they shall dress the man whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on the horseback through the city square, and call before him, Kach yaaseh la'ish asher hamelech hafetz bikaro. So shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. Now, one second. I will say, first and foremost, where is the crown? So I'm not the only one that thought about this question, or we are not the only one that thought about this question. All right? Take a look on Rashi. Rashi himself says that in source number 4. Rashi in source number 4 says, let the robe and the horse be handed to a man. He says, But he did not, Haman did not mention the crown. Why? Because he saw that the king became jealous when he said that they should place the crown on another person's head. Or in other words, I would say, he saw not in jealousy, but he saw the face of the king when he said, okay, you know what, the clothing, no problem. The horse, but the crown itself, you want to put on someone else? No way. So Haman understood while he was talking, maybe he's saying too much.
Went too far, really.
Exactly. In his plans. So he didn't mention. I think it's a wonderful reading of Rashi. Wonderful reading of Rashi. They can read this really, this dialogue between Ahasuerus and Haman in that sense. And the other thing that I want us to pay attention is, and I highlighted, is that from verse 7, since Haman started talking, to verse 9 till he finishes, he's mentioning the word king. Or royalty, in Hebrew it's the same word, melech or malchut, the root, mem lamed chaf. He's mentioning it in 3 verses 8 times. 8 times. He has king and king and royal and king and king and king. And alright, think about it for a moment. If the king really listens to him, and in 3 verses, in 1 sentence, alright, he's mentioning 8 times the word king, obviously Ahasuerus says to himself, this guy wants to be the king. This guy really, what he really cares about is to be the king. There's no reason otherwise for him to say for 8 times the word king or royalty or melech, so on, in 3 verses. All right? So in that sense, and that's what I want to claim here, one of the chidushim that when we now learn in the Megillah is that Ahasuerus started to understand that he needs to get rid of Haman even before Esther revealed her Jewish identity. Even before. Alright? In other words, what Esther will say, and we'll see it in a moment, when Esther reveals who she is and what Haman is planning and so on, that's only the last nail in the, how do you say that?
The
yeah, exactly, in the coffin, right? And so on. So, we'll see all of this in a moment. Terry, thank you very much for coming. It's all good. Alright, let's continue reading. Yeah, don't tell her any spoilers. Alright, let's continue reading. So, let's see what happened. And this is, again, I told you guys, this is really Hollywood stuff, right? So, in verse 10, the king said to Haman, hurry, take the clothing and the horse, and you, as he spoke, and do so to Mordechai, HaYehudi, the Judean, who sits in the king's gate. Do not omit anything from all that you have spoken. Why does it matter to say the ending here? Don't omit anything from what you have spoken. Why is that important? What do you think? Yeah.
Well, we all know that from previous classes, they're rivals. So the first thing he's going to do is to retract some of the things. And the only person that knows anything that's going on this planet is between Ahasuerus and
Haman.
There's no check.
So he's the only one that can know really what happens. Okay, that's very interesting. I haven't thought in this direction, Joel. Interesting. That, like, in other words, you say, who can know if that's not what he said? Only Ahasuerus will be able to know if that's really what Haman planned. That's a wonderful reading. Yeah.
I'm shocked that Haman here doesn't use his big ego and protest something. I mean, the king might be expecting it, and so is saying, look, buddy, I know what you know in his mind, although it doesn't say it. I know what you're thinking. Too bad.
Ah, Skoye. Baruch Shekivanta. There is Rabbi Dr. Mordechai Breuer, was a very big Talmid Chacham in Tanakh and in Israel. He wrote a book, and he said exactly this. He said in the book, he said that this scene here, and I haven't brought it inside because it's really a lot to say, but because he said it, I'll say it. That scene tells us. Really? That at the end of the day, Mordechai was able to say no to Haman, but Haman is not able to say no to Mordechai. Like at the end of the day, that's really where everything turns around. Here we see that Mordechai is stronger than Haman. After this scene, Haman could try to prevent and protest, say no. Like Mordechai protested. Mordechai said, I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to move. I'm not going to bow in front of you. But he's not doing anything. He's not protesting. He's not doing anything. In other words, Breuer tells us it is important for the story, for the plot. So we will see here exactly this: that Haman is not as strong in that sense; he's not protesting as Mordechai.
But there's a difference between protesting to another courtier and protesting the king. You just don't ever say to the king, "Your Highness, you can change your mind." You don't say that.
I'll remind you that also the commandment to bow to Haman came from the king.
Yeah.
It also came from the king. Both commandments came from the king. I mean, still, Mordechai didn't do it. But, yeah. In other words, what his colleagues told him is like, you're saying no to the commandments, king. You can't do it. Right. You say maybe the king is not in the scene. He doesn't see it. Maybe the king doesn't know about it. All right, that's different interpretation. I hear. At the end of the day, as Harvey said, and as Dr. Breuer said, at the end of the day, Haman is doing something to Mordechai, and he cannot say no. Or at least he doesn't say no. When Mordechai needed to do something to honor Haman, and he did say no. All right, so this comparison is very, very interesting. All right, so let's continue. So Haman took the clothing and the horse, verse 11, and he dressed Mordechai and led him through the city, through the city square, and he called before him, "So shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor." Right? Think about the scene of Haman taking Mordechai on the horse and so on. I brought even a picture over here at the bottom of source number 7. In source number 7, you can see there is from a Persian record that's not Mordechai and Haman, but this is a woman here in that sense. But again, we see that riding someone on a horse in the Persian Empire was really a thing of honor. All right, there was an action of honor. If you want to honor someone who's important, you put him on a horse and someone walks with him throughout the city. That was one of the things they did. Try to compare it in our days to us, to write like there is, the delegation of the president of something, that he can, or the queen, again, that can be in a car. Now it will be inside a car after different things that happened. But again, 50 years ago, it used to be that he would... It will all be open, right? And that's, unfortunately, we know how also JFK was assassinated and so on. So in the same sense, it's the same. You put him on the horse, there's a delegation, a lot of people that are walking him throughout the streets and so on. That's a Persian way of paying respect. Now, Professor Henschke was a huge Talmid Chacham in Israel years ago. Professor Henschke says that we should read it in a different way. It's not that the end of the verse 11, it's not that the end of verse 11 has period, but it has a question mark. In other words, "So shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor" is a question that Haman is asking about himself, to himself. He's saying, "So shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor? So shall be done to me? I am the person that needs to be honored here, not Mordechai. How can that be done to me?" Brother Henske says, there's no reason for us to read it as that's what he said out loud. Maybe we should read it also in the sense that he says it about himself. And he asks, he cries out and he says, like, "Why is it happening to me? What I'm supposed to be here on the horse now. I'm supposed to be honored, not him." So we read it with a question mark. I think it was worthwhile noting in that sense. Now, Mordechai returned after this. Mordechai returned to the king's gate, all right? But Haman pushed himself to the house, mournful and with covered head. So first of all, you see the verse. The verse is really comparing what Mordechai is doing afterwards to what Haman is doing afterwards. Mordechai is returning to Sha'ar HaMelech, to the king's gate, which means he's literally going back to work. That's what he's doing. Again, he's Yoshev Sha'ar HaMelech. That's where he sits. That's his office. Mordechai, after everything that happens, goes to office. Why is it important for us to know that? Why is it important for us to know that after everything that happened, Mordechai goes back to his office, goes back to work? I want to claim it's important for us to know because for Mordechai, he wasn't touched by it. Like, he didn't care. What he cared, again, is part of the transformation that Mordechai's character had in last chapter, last week, as we spoke about, that Mordechai now cares more about the people than about himself. That's part of the transformation, part of the transition that he went through. And in that sense, he really doesn't care about the dignity. He cares about the idea that Esther will go and tell Ahasuerus everything that she should tell him. All right? On the other hand, we do know that Haman goes back to his home, not back to his office. Not only he goes back to his home, but he pushed himself to his house, mournful and with covered head. Now, first of all, he pushed himself. What does it mean that he pushed himself in that sense? Like, it's not that someone pushed him, right? Not in that sense. So, one of the answers that someone can say it in that sense, right, is that, he pushed. He tried to enter as quickly as possible, so people will not see him because of the embarrassment that happened to him. Another answer that we can give is related to the other word here, which is mournful. Avel. Why was he mourning? Like, why was Haman mourning here? What happened? Like, why was he mourning? So you can say he mourned because he was sad. But using the word avelut here, it has another context, right? It's not only sadness. He wasn't just sad. It's a, he's in a veil. Yeah.
Yeah. Power
that I'm losing. Okay, so look at the Midrash. Midrash in source number 8 says as follows. I can't say it's a wonderful story, but I can. You can see the Midrash in here. Really, I'll tell you. I'll be honest. What we read, but not for no reason. There is an entire Masechta on Megillah. Not for no reason. As we said, we know. We spoke about last week. The Megillah doesn't mention even once the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Name of God is not mentioned even once throughout the Megillah. So it makes sense for the sages in later generation to try and build and write down as many codex as they can to fill the Megillah with some spirituality. Because the Megillah lacks this spiritualism. It lacks this godliness inside of it. So there's a lot of religious texts later on in later generations that are trying to fill it up. That's why there's a lot of Midrashim on the Megillah. That's why there's a Masecht on the Megillah and so on to fill all those up. So take a look, which, by the way, we don't have for Hanukkah, right? We don't Masecht for Hanukkah. We don't have. We just have 2.5 pages on Masechet Shabbos. Let's talk about Hanukkah. But like Hanukkah doesn't have Masechta. But Megillah does have a Mishnah and so on. So take a look in. I brought in source number 8. Take a look at the Midrash brought in the Gemara in source number 8. The verse states, "And he proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." As Haman, look at the story. As Haman was taking Mordechai along the street of Haman's house, Haman's daughter was standing on the roof and saw the spectacle. She thought to herself that the one who is riding on the horse must be her father, and the one walking before him must be Mordechai. She then took a chamber pot full of fesses and cast its contents onto the head of her father. She was sure she's doing it on the head of Mordechai, but she threw it on the head of her father, whom she mistakenly took as Mordechai. When Haman raised his eyes in disgust afterward and looked up at his daughter, she saw that he was her father. In her distress, she fell from the roof to the ground and died. I'm telling you, it is very creative. The Midrash is trying to fill up with different ideas. What is the message here? But once again, yeah, Steve.
No, I'm going to say it's totally prophetic. You know, there was once upon a time in the English course that if a person was sentenced to hang, the judge would cover his head and would announce the sentence because it was such a grand thing. And this is almost like Haman was getting ready.
You're reading my mind because I'll say it at the end of the class. There's something, exactly this idea that he puts the head. I don't know if you thought about it, but exactly. Well, right. It's something related to the Megillah. So I'll say that. There's a lot of spoilers here this night. However, like, what's the reason of this story? What is the story trying to add to the Megillah? The Megillah is filled with plot and twists and so on. Why do we need all of this? So first and foremost, to see that if the authors of the Megillah, Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, used the word Avel, then the rabbis afterwards had to find a solution to understand why Avel. So obviously it's not written in the Megillah. But what they're trying to do here is using the word Avel and make more laugh on Haman. Not only that Haman took Mordechai and Mordechai was on the horse, also his daughter threw the thing on his face. And more than that, it was so tragic because also his daughter died that day. Like, it can be lower than that. Like, they're totally, totally, totally killing the guy. Like, really. It can be lower than, can be worse than that. Another thing that I think is important to say here, why do we think they're really, really, really looking at the scene as, I would say, they're trying to make Haman as miserable as possible. The phrase in Hebrew, kacha ya'aseh la'ish asher, thus should be done to the person that, appears only 3 times in Tanakh. 3 times, twice in the Megillah, as we saw, and one more where? But I like the question. Sometimes there are some people that can answer. Yosef, he said, I brought Yosef in source number 7. I'm not reading it inside. Yosef from the book, Yosef, he said, I saw it there, va'ikre'u lefanav. They put him on, Yosef was put on a horse, and they called in front of him Avrech. That's what the Parsha said. That's from the book. But where do we have kacha ya'aseh la'ish asher? Actually, it's a difficult one. Challenging one. So take a look in source number 6. Source number 6 in Devarim. When we talk about Ibum, alright? Ibum in a sense, when a woman marries a man, and the man dies, and he doesn't have children, then she is marrying his brother. All right? If for some reason this marriage is not going to happen, we're doing a ceremony called chalitza. All right? Chalitza, for different reasons, she takes off her sandal and so on. A lot to be said here in that sense. But when the Torah is describing the laws of this chalitza, it says as follows. Take a look. Then, reading from the Torah, it's verse number 6. Then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders and take off his shoe from his foot and spit in his face. And she shall answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. Kach ha'yaseh la'ish asher. That's the only other place we have it in Tanakh. Obviously, Anshei Knesset HaGdola, who are also involved in halacha, and very much in different halachot, also of Ibum and Chalitza, they knew it. And not for no reason, they used the same wording, and they wanted to allude, to refer, to Chalitza and to Ibum. Because this is a humiliating timing. When they're doing it, they're taking off the sandal and she's speeding and so on. It's very humiliating. It's not a happy scene. And using the same words from that ceremony to this thing on the horse tells us that we should feel the same. That when we read the story about Haman and Mordechai on the horse, we should think about Yevoma and Chalitza and about how humiliating this scene is supposed to be for Haman and how not nice it was for him. The entire scene here is built in order for us in a certain way also to pity Haman and to say, take a look what's going on. He can be more miserable in that sense. All right? So let's finish the chapter. Haman told Zeresh his wife, verse 13, Haman told Zeresh his wife and all his supporters, again, you see, Zeresh is not his supporter, right? He's his wife, but not his supporter. All that had happened to him and his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, truly, since Mordechai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Judea and this end, you will not prevail over him, for you will surely fall before him. First and foremost, now she's honest. Last week we saw Zeresh giving him an advice, hang up Mordechai. I wanted to claim that this wasn't serious. She wasn't serious. She made laugh of her husband. That's why she's not a supporter of him. Now she's speaking honestly. Now she's serious. She said, Haman, you have no chance against Mordechai. He is a Yehudi. He's Jewish. He's Judean. You have no chance against him. That's why also they changed from being his supporters to the wise men. You see the difference? The group was called the supporters. And then they're called his wise men. Why is the difference? I want to claim. I want to say. Because look what they're saying. They're wise. They're saying, like, you're not going to be able to deal with him. Like, you're not going to be able to prevail. That's why they're wise. They're called wise men, not only his supporters. They're not his supporters when they say that. If they were his supporters, they will support him. But they're not supporting him, so they're not his supporters anymore. While they were still speaking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther prepared. Now, unfortunately, the chapter ends here. It doesn't necessarily need to end here. We know that the division to chapters is not Jewish. It's Christian, and it's way later on, and like it has really no meaning. The story continues, actually, to chapter 7. So let's jump, like the Jewish understanding of it, and we'll jump to chapter 7. The king and Haman came to drink with Queen Esther. They came to drink with Queen Esther? If you remember, and I didn't bring it inside, first of all, this is the second feast that Esther is having. In the first feast, it didn't say that. It didn't say that they're drinking with Queen Esther. It said that they went to the feast of Queen Esther. Of Esther, actually, not Queen Esther. Why is it important to know that they drank with her? So it's very cute. I'm not going to say everything because we really don't have a lot of time. But within the commentators, there is a very cute disagreement. Rather, whether I would say Esther drank and ate, only drank, or not, none of those. All right, there's different opinions. What exactly did she do here? Because it says they drank with her. All right, in a sense. Not going to get into it, but if you have some time, you can see I brought some sources inside that can tell us what exactly happened here. Was she eating or not, and so on. If you remember, in the first feast yesterday, she was still in her fasting. Maybe she couldn't eat, and so on. Yeah.
She didn't say that she was drinking. She just said that they came to drink.
With her.
But they didn't say she was drinking. Mm. So
That's why, according to some say she had a drink. You're right. Mm. But the idea that they need to drink and so on. All right? So, let's continue. The king asked Esther on the second day, too, at the wine feast, what is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom, and it shall be done. Now, if you remember, we are still in a mood where Ahasuerus thinks, believes that maybe Haman is trying to assassinate him. He's trying to take over the crown, right? He wants his in the throne instead of him. Read all the scene from now on in that light, all right? Read everything that he asked. Ad chatzi amalchut, until, in English, right, it says, up to half of the kingdom. What is up to half of the kingdom? Usually we say, oh, he's large. He's right, Esther, you're going to get up to half of the kingdom will be yours. But if we read it in this light, that we say that Achashverosh is worried that someone will take over his throne, when you read it, then you understand that he says up to half, not more than half. You're not going to get everything. Right? It's up to half. You're with me? You get it? Right? Up to half. In other words, most of it stays mine. We're not going to give most of it. So we can read it as usual. The regular reading is, oh, I'm large, we'll give you a lot. The second reason is, second understanding is, if you think you can take my throne, think again. I'm not going to give it to you. Everything you can get is only up to half of my kingdom. What? Because he doesn't know. First of all, Esther didn't tell it. First and foremost, he wanted, we saw last week, he wanted to know where Esther comes from. What is her nation? What is her background? He married this woman. He has no idea where she comes from. This woman is coming to drink with him and with Haman and so on. He really thinks, and we see it in a couple of verses, he really thinks there is an affair, that Esther has an affair with Haman. We'll see it in a moment. He really thinks that Haman and Esther are having this kind of plot against him.
And you're saying he really should have said, I'll give you the whole mouth, or what? 75%.
He shouldn't say anything, but the idea it is said, like it is said, it doesn't need to appear here. But the idea it is said as it is said, I want to claim to read it in that way, right? That like only up the only
or
up to half.
He's trying to test her to see where she.
He's trying to test her definitely. But again, put in the back of your mind that Esther risked herself. She told Mordechai, "I'm risking my life when I'm coming to Achashverosh without him calling me." We said last week when she came up to Achashverosh, it was unusual. It's not an unusual thing for the woman, for the wife to come to the king and do this and that, and not the king calling her. And the idea that she came up to the king without the king calling her, first and foremost, says to the king himself, what's going on here? So she did all the things that she does is suspicious in a way. She comes to the king without the king wanting her. She invites the king with Haman to the feast. The king said, what do you want? She said, I'll tell you tomorrow. Wait a day. And come again tomorrow with Haman. And then Haman builds a post in his backyard. And Haman comes in the middle of the night. Try to understand from the point of view of Achashverosh how everything goes here. All right? There must be something that Esther and Haman are planning against Achashverosh. All right? Let's continue. So it says as followed. Queen Esther answered and said, and this is, you see, now we get to the climax of the story. If I have found favor in your eyes, the king, and if it pleases the king, may my life be given as my wish and my people as my request. She said, I don't have a wish. I don't have a request. My people and my nation are my request. Why? For we have been sold, I and my nation, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. And we being sold as slaves and maidservants, I would be quiet. For the distress in the war, in Hebrew it says the tsar, is not worth the trouble to the king. That's when she reveals herself. Now, is she really revealing herself? She doesn't say the word Jews even once. Think about it for a moment. We always know that Esther reveals who she is. Did she say Jews here? She kept on saying only my people. She didn't mention the Jews even once here. Achashverosh until this point still has no clue. First, where does Esther come from? Second of all, if you remember when Haman asked his permission to go and kill all Jews, he didn't say Jews. He said there's people, there's a nation, they're scattered around. You're not paying taxes. I need to bring some money. We'll kill all of you because I want their money. And so on. He doesn't know it. More than that, I'll tell you. Look, Esther again is focusing on the financial aspect of it. We were sold. For we have been sold, I and my nation. Not killed. We were sold. And more than that, if we were sold as slaves, I would be quiet. She's talking financially to the king. She understands that really what matters. If she would come to the king and tell, oh, I'm sorry, King Achashverosh, I'm Jewish, and please have pity on all Jews because he wants to kill us, why would Achashverosh care? Why would he care? She's smart. She knows she needs to talk to him, to convince him in a way that will make him understand. That's why, according to some of the Parshanim, commented, we'll read it outside, we don't have time, when she says, if we have been sold as slave and maidservants, what she really says here is not that she prefers to be sold as maidservants or slaves. She just said, Haman's plan to bring money back is not good enough. He will lose manpower if he kills all of us. It would have been better if he would just have a plan to just sell us, to bring slaves. That would bring back money. Well, take slaves, don't have the kingdom takes all. The king takes all the properties and all the money that the slaves have, and he uses them as manpower, free manpower. What's wrong? She said, if that's really the thing, if it's really the money, there's a better plan. There's a better plan than what Haman does. In other words, what Haman does is not because of the fine. It's not going to help you, King Ahasuerus. You should understand that what he's doing is out of other motives. What is the motivation? Personal, political rival with Mordechai, kind of anti-Semitism that he had to the Jewish people as the descendant of Agag and so on. Yes, Avram.
Doesn't the king know that Mordechai and Esther are related?
Great question, which I have no answer to.
Because you said Mordechai,
I don't have a good answer. You're right. Sorry? If we know, like, how do we, how should we assume that Ahasuerus didn't know that Esther and Mordechai are related? So, I don't know. There's some answers in the Parshanim. My personal opinion on this is I think he does know it, but he doesn't know where Esther comes from. He has no reason to believe that Esther is Jewish, even if Mordechai is Jewish. What about Esther? Mordechai's name, again, remember, he assimilated. Maybe he married a non-Jewish girl. Like, why should he assume that if Mordechai is Jewish, then Esther is Jewish? Like, I don't think he knows all the way that he's her uncle or cousin or married to her, like, whatever that is. Okay, she has a relative. She has someone she's related who's Jewish. He doesn't say anything about Esther. Obviously, he knows that Mordechai is Jewish, but nothing about Esther. All right? So take a look what happens here. So she said all of this. King Ahasuerus said, verse 5, and he said to Queen Esther. You see that? What's going on? King Ahasuerus said? Said what? And he said to Queen Esther? Like, something we don't. Vayomer Melech Ahasuerus, Vayomer Le'Esther Hamalka. Something is going on here. Who is this, and which is who has presumed to do so? He has no idea. He's sitting here, Esther and Haman. He doesn't think it's Haman that is doing it. He doesn't understand that it's Haman that is next to him. But again, that's my reading. According to some of the Parshanim, he does understand it. But he just, for some reason, he needs the clarification from Esther. In that sense, so he can do something. Without her clarification, he can't act. But remember, he wants to act already against Haman, because he really thinks Haman has this kind of plot against him. All right, let's finish the chapter. And he says as followed. There we are. One sec. Yeah, here we are. Esther said, an adversary, tzar, and an enemy, this evil Haman. And Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. Look how Esther is called here. It's not before Ahasuerus and Esther. It's before the king and the queen. He looks at them as a couple. The king and the queen are looking at Haman and they're saying, oh my goodness, what's going to happen to me? Now what do you think is going to happen? That Ahasuerus will just go and kill him on the spot. But he's not doing it, right? What happens? Verse 7. The king rose in his wrath from the wine feast to the house garden, and Haman remained to plead for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that the king had determined to do him evil. All right. It looks like, why didn't the king do it? Why did he go out to the garden? It's interesting. So Ibn Ezra, I brought some answers here. So we'll see one of those because we don't have time. So one of the answers here is from the Hoyle Moshe, beautiful commentary on the Megillah and other books. Hoyle Moshe, in source number 19, says as follows. Take a look. You know what happened here? Haman's head, he says, was decapitated. Was decapitated. Before he was hanged, he was already killed. Why? So the king will not need to see his face anymore, and therefore will not be angry anymore. Same story, he says, is known by Olerius about a Persian king named Shashefi that was offended by one of his ministers who made laugh of him. The king left then the room, and his minister was sure that he would not be punished. But after a while, the king came back and commanded to decapitate him. In other words, what Hoyle Moshe says, and this is what I wanted to tell, that is based on Steve, what you mentioned before, the word in Hebrew here is Ufnei Haman Chafu. Chafu is not a word like we translate what Chafu means. So some say they covered their head, he put his head, the hand, on the head of of Haman before he was killed. They put like a chuppah, right? With their hands on it, because that's one of the opinions. Other opinion, like Hoyle Moshe said, Pnei Haman Chapu means that he really killed him on the spot. That's when Haman died. We're done with Haman. That's all. We don't wait to hang him over. Other opinions said that they put a sackcloth on his head before they hanged him and so on. But something has happened here in that sense. And Ahasuerus comes back and he says as follows. We'll finish the chapter. The king returned from the house guard in verse 8. The king returned from the house guard into the house of the wine feast. And Haman was falling on the couch upon which Esther was. Again, you see that Haman, that Ahasuerus already thinks there is a plot. Something is happening between Esther and between Esther and Haman, and Haman was falling on the bed of Esther and so on, right? The king said, would you also assault the queen with me in the house? The words of the king's mouth and Haman's face was covered. That's the covered, means whether he was decapitated or so on, all right? Harvona in verse 9, one of the eunuchs who were before the king said, behold, all of the posts that Haman has made for Mordechai, who spoke well of the king, which stands in Haman's house, 50 cubits high. The king said, hang him on it. They hanged Haman on the post that he had prepared for Mordechai, and the king's wrath abated. That's the end of Haman. So again, according to some commentators, he was killed and then hanged. Some commentators say, no, he was hanged, and that's how he was killed. But two things I want us to take from here. First and foremost, still, Ahasuerus doesn't know that Esther is Jewish. Right? Haman is dead, and she didn't say she's Jewish. Wait for next week. We'll see what's going to happen with that. Second of all, Ahasuerus is also angry on Esther. Put that in the back of your mind that he really thinks there was a plot. Haman and Esther has a plot against him. They're having a plan to try and assassin him. So we'll see next week that Esther is also she's also asking for her life before Ahasuerus. All right? We'll see next week. In a sense, Haman is dead here, all right? We'll see his name also in the coming chapters. But in that sense, it's important for us to know that if there would be, I would say, any of credits or the end of the movie that Haman is hanged and everything, it will be now. But then the audience will say, wait a minute, what is the ending? Like, what was Esther? What about Mordechai? What about the Jews? What about the decree? He didn't cancel the decree yet. He just killed Haman. He didn't cancel anything. All this will be Bezrat Hashem after the credits. Will be Bezrat Hashem next week. So thank you everyone for coming tonight.